Right now, though, we're ready to start the second hour of the show. Happy to have a guest in studio with us to talk about a new book. She is, I'm going to read it right here from the book, the John Mitchell Nickerson Professor of Political Science at the University of Maine, the author of Muffled Echoes, Oliver North, and the Politics of Public Opinion, and Pathways to Polling, Crisis, Cooperation, and the Making of Public Opinion Professions. Her new book, written with Douglas B. Harris, is terrific. It's called At War with Government, How Conservatives Weaponize Distrust from Goldwater to Trump. Dr. Amy Fried joins us. Amy, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, it's really super to be here.
This is, it's such a good book and a fascinating look back at the evolution of the Republican Party over the last five decades plus. And much of this, I think, goes back even further than that. Is it safe to say that some of what we're seeing and have seen in recent years with the Republican Party even goes back to the post-war period when people were upset with some of the New Deal reforms of FDR?
That's absolutely true. But, you know, there's a lot of ways in which the Republican Party has also changed over the years. But the main thing that we're looking at is how Republicans have seized on a certain amount of distrust in government, which is a very normal thing in American democracy. I mean, it really goes back to the founding and the revolution and all that. And some amount of distrust and skepticism is a good thing. But in more recent years, we argue it's taken a different turn. It's become something that really Republicans are trying to use in different ways in politics.
There is a healthy distrust, and then there is this weaponized distrust that you write about. And I thought this was very interesting. You talk about four different benefits of distrust, and I'd like to look at each one of those. Let's start with the organizational. What are the benefits of organizational distrust?
Well, what we're saying is that this can be a common thing that will bring together different aspects of the party coalition, because all of our parties in the United States are always coalitions, because we're basically a two-party system. So to get all these different people that sometimes don't have that much in common, you have to form a coalition. You have a big range. So distrust becomes the glue to pull people together, whether you don't like the government for social policy reasons or economic reasons or whatever it happens to be. That becomes a kind of central element of it, and helps the different groups work together and different candidates work together.
That's very interesting too, because when you talk about the Trump phenomenon, you point out that coalition was a very diverse group of well, in some ways, some pretty ragtag and scary outfits all finding room under that umbrella.
Right. And really, there were some people who didn't vote that much who started to vote because they liked Trump in particular. Mm. I mean, you know, you have a range of groups there. But some people who really came out of the woodwork and they were attracted to Trump for his, you know, a lot of the elements that people have criticized him for a very sort of extreme personal rhetoric, for, you know, the anti-immigrant sort of stuff, some racialized messages, all those sorts of things that they like that about him.
I think we, in Maine, we saw a lot of that in regard to Paul LePage as well, that he, in many ways, as Trump did, embodied that distrust in government and the way it's always been done.
I would agree with that. In fact, LePage himself said he was Trump before Trump, you know. So on the other hand, I mean, personally, I would have various things to say about LePage as a politician and about his policies. But he was someone who had more interest in governing than I think Trump did. I mean, right. You know, I mean, look at what just happened with this big infrastructure bill, which is on its way right past, but it's looking like it's going to get all the way through the whole thing. Trump used to say infrastructure week, but, you know, he didn't really know how to do that. Right. He didn't know how to follow through.
We'll come back to that a little bit later on. Amy Fried with us here on Downtown. When it comes to the electoral benefits of distrust, certainly distrust is effective at mobilizing your people.
Right. And, you know, there's a phrase people sometimes use, running to get into government, you know, by running against government, you know. So that's what a lot of it is. And it can be, you know, combined with a lot of other kinds of arguments. In the Gingrich years, when Gingrich was, well, first a backbencher in the House of Representatives, and then in the early Bill Clinton presidency, became, you know, one of the leaders, one of the top leaders and strategists. He put together all kinds of campaign efforts and messages, really training candidates using all these messages of distrust and really outright calling Democrats corrupt and un-American.
What are the institutional benefits of distrust?
Well, with this, what we talk about is the efforts to move power away from institutions that the Democrats control towards institutions that Republicans control. And so you do that by saying you can't trust that particular institution, or sometimes an individual is like too powerful. So, you know, all these you see in the Republican platform of 2016 calling Obama a power-hungry czar, you know, not exactly, but, you know, pretty much. And yet, you know, in 2020, when the Republicans sort of didn't do a platform, they instead put out a statement that said, oh, our party is about Donald Trump. And they had been pushing for greater executive power through the entire Trump presidency.
Policy benefits, there are a number of those, clearly, and they've been exploited by the Republicans for years.
Right. I mean, what we have an example running through the book, but it really applies to lots of other things. And the example is health policy. So, you know, today we could have an ad. There have been ads. There will be ads in 2022 saying that, you know, let's say Jared Golden believes in socialist health care, which is a little absurd. But in any case, I mean, but that's been used all the way through, really. You know, anytime there have been efforts which really go back to Harry Truman's presidency to try to expand healthcare, it's all called socialism and a way of government trying to take power, and therefore you should fear it. Mm-hmm. And then you get the death panel idea under Obama, and, you know, some bureaucrat is going to decide who lives and dies. That's a very frightening kind of thing. You know, obviously you shouldn't trust that. So we see that through lots and lots of different policy areas and over time.
I thought this was very interesting when you talk about the element of race, which is a factor here as well, and how Social Security is framed as a benefit to hardworking white people, while welfare is seen as only benefiting the black community.
Right, and that's how people, you know, there's all of these studies that others have done that we draw from that show that's how people associate it. They tend to code Social Security more as white and those other policies as involving minorities. But yet, actually, if you look at a lot of social welfare policy, whatever they are, whether it's income support, food stamps, now called SNAP, you know, actually more white people get them than people of color.
Things that I experience in my day job, like free and reduced lunch.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. And of course, you know, I mean, look at our state. We're the whitest state. The new census figures came out today. Right. You know, we're still the whitest state. So the poverty in Maine is primarily poverty among white people.
In the book, you explain that the GOP is anti-government in rhetoric, but not always in practice. And there was really no better example of that than Ronald Reagan, who's the poster boy for the movement conservatives, and yet did a lot of things, as we were talking before we came on here, that would not be considered conservative at all 40 years later.
Absolutely. And, it, you know, a prime example of that is his development of this health policy that then got repealed for catastrophic coverage for the elderly. It was repealed because of the way the tax for it was set up, and there was a bit of a tax revolt. But, you know, his Secretary of Health and Human Services, who had been a doctor, had been a governor in Indiana, Otis Bowen, he was very much in support of that. And then Reagan ends up adopting that and, you know, getting that passed. But also if anyone should read this book, as different people read it, if you read that chapter about Reagan, starts with what I thought was like a great story. We have a lot of good stories in this book, and that's something that I want to mention to the audience, is that we really tried to make this a very accessible book for everyone. But there's a story about Reagan doing a press conference where he comes in and he says his sort of very famous words associated with him, which is, you know, the nine most scary words in the English language, or I'm from the government, I'm here to help. And then he instantly, right after that, launches into talking about how we should have more help, and he was going to provide more help for farmers in the Midwest, that they were, you know, they were having problems. So, you know, even though he's saying he's anti-government, or, you know, in general, we should be afraid of government, that's what's scary, someone's there to help. And he had been doing this for quite a while. He'd been building a reputation before he even, you know, ran for any office with this kind of point of view. When it came to this case, he had a different view. So, you know, yeah, Reagan was not as, you know, firmly anti-government. And as I was saying to you, I think some of that is because he had a background in being a governor. You know, governors, when they run for other offices, often are interested in actually getting things done. Right. And that's actually true, you know, off topic a little bit, but in the Senate, you know, you look at the various governors in the Senate, a lot of times people have come from being governors. They really want to, like, pass stuff and make things better for people.
You mentioned Newt Gingrich. When he rose to become Speaker of the House, he really, I think, weaponized this distrust better than anybody until Trump came along. And one of the things that he did that has certainly changed our politics is the idea of nationalizing congressional races. And with changes in campaign funding, opening up all of that dark money out there, we've seen that rise to new levels right here in the state of Maine.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, he had this common platform for people to run on, the Contract with America. And he had, you know, he really did teach people to use personal vitriol. That was part of his brand. And it still is. I mean, he's still around. He's still doing those sorts of things. So highly negative characterizations of people who are on the other side of you. Not, you know, I disagree with you, you have your point of view, I have mine, let's talk about it, let's work something out if we can. But really, this just incredible personal negativity.
We're talking with Amy Fried. Her book is At War with Government, How Conservatives Weaponized Distrust from Goldwater to Trump. There are some parallels between George Bush, George W. Bush, his presidency, and Donald Trump's, in that in both of those presidencies, we saw the need for government, that there are some things a government can do well, like manage a crisis, whether it's 9/11 or the response to Hurricane Katrina.
Right. And, you know, Bush was seen as handling one well and the other is not well. So, you know, there were big public responses to that. I mean, when 9/11 happened, his approval ratings went super high, over 90%, which is, you know, imagine that. It's just hugely high. But then when Katrina happened and he wasn't doing a good job, and there were all these images on TV of people who needed to be rescued, they went down a lot. And, I mean, Trump had an opportunity in a way that if he had come in and managed the pandemic well, we would be in a very different kind of situation.
Absolutely.
You know, as a country, and we could have had a very different political outcome.
The Tea Party arose to power in the middle of the Obama presidency, and they took this distrust to a whole new level, to the point of flat-out obstruction, not wanting any bills to get passed. And it seems so antithetical, the idea of electing people to a lawmaking body who don't want to make any law.
Right, absolutely. The Tea Party caucus in Congress was so obstructionist. And, you know, I tell this story also, which comes from a journalist account, Tim Alberto's, one of his books, about, which many people have probably already heard, about how the first night of Obama's presidency, on inaugural night, there's this dinner in Washington which actually is organized by Frank Luntz, who does a lot of focus groups. You still see him around today. But all these different leaders who came together and said, how can we just stop anything from happening? And things were in pretty bad shape when Obama came in. I mean, we were losing something like 900,000 jobs a month.
Right.
You know, the economy was just crashing, and he had to try to turn it around, which is, you know, obviously more difficult to come in the middle of crisis than when things are going well. And yet they, you know, they just wanted to stop everything. And then the Tea Party caucus, which was particularly in the House of Representatives, pushed out a lot of establishment Republicans,
right.
You know, and some senators also, there were some primaries. And so they took this power, and the bodies have just gotten harder and harder to really accomplish anything.
Trump used that distrust of government perhaps as well as anybody, but I'm curious what you think. The embrace of Trump by the GOP didn't come right away. There were lots of efforts to derail his candidacy. I think some didn't take it seriously. But when it became clear that he would get the nomination, they found a way to rally behind him. How much of that, if any, was based on policy, and how much was just a GOP tired of losing?
I think, you know, it's just almost completely electoral when it comes to party leaders, because a lot of party leaders were really tentative at various points, and there were attempts to try to stop him. You know, and what's odd is when Trump ran, some of the things he said in his rhetoric were not typical Republican kinds of things.
No.
Like, he actually said, I'm going to get health care for everyone. Of course, then he said, oh, it's so easy, we can do it in 2 days, you know, but he never had a plan for it. You know, if he had tried to do something big on healthcare, probably, I mean, that wouldn't have been something that Republicans wanted. I mean, ultimately, I think what his presidency accomplished, if you're going to say what actually got done, it was tax cuts and judges. That's basically
right.
It. And those are in some ways the easiest things to get done, because tax cuts you can pass without getting, you know, these super majorities. You can't filibuster it. You can do it through reconciliation, this odd process that the Senate has. And judges, they you know, got rid of the filibuster for, you know, most federal judges. So, you know, they were able to pass those as well. So, you know, I think that's what he ultimately did, because he didn't. But and then at the same time, he brought this whole overlay of just, you know, railing against government, this whole thing about the deep state and going after people in these very nasty individual ways.
And also not filling a lot of government jobs in his efforts to shrink the bureaucracy. And I think a lot of Americans would be on board with that. But when you have a pandemic, it's good to have a functioning national government. And clearly that wasn't the case.
Right. I mean, all these public health positions got undermine, and really the whole underlying science apparatuses of the federal government were harmed under Trump. Now, some of that was him, and some of that were some of the people around him, because if you look at Mark Meadows, for example, who was chief of staff for a time, and some other people who were in the administration, they were really from that kind of Tea Party anti-government
right.
wing. So they were finding ways to undermine things. Like at one point, you know, telling people who are in all the economists who worked on issues to do with food security. Oh, you're going to have to move to Iowa. These are people who are living in the Washington, D.C. area. They got families there. They have a spouse who has a different job. They have kids in school. Oh, you have to move to Iowa next month. So they, you know, so they lost a lot of very talented people. And then that reduces government's ability to like figure out what's going on and try to have good solutions.
Is it safe to say, Amy, that one of the results of decades of this is the idea that a lot of people have that government only benefits the undeserving?
Yeah, that is definitely part of a lot of these policy messages. Either that government benefits the undeserving poor, or it benefits just the rich. And, you know, you can look, I don't know, you look at tax policy, the last tax bill did mostly benefit the very rich, without a doubt. Mm-hmm. But people, you know, people feel disempowered. I think as some of these new policies are rolling out under the Biden administration, they should be making more of a fuss about it in a way, you know, and talking about government can work, you know, giving people that bigger message, because there are times that we definitely need government. I mean, you know, when we're always, I think, going to be a country with a very, very vibrant private sector. We want people to be entrepreneurial and start businesses and run businesses and all of that. I mean, that is really important. But we also cannot have a very well-functioning government or country, not a very well-functioning country and economy, good society, if we only have, you know, private sector, because that their job is not to look out for the public interest.
Right. And as you point out in the afterword, you know, this distrust in government has had political consequences. But in the last couple of years, we've seen life and death consequences to this, because it's led to a large segment of our population now distrusting scientists and the government, and in particular government scientists when it comes to COVID. And we're seeing the consequences everywhere in the country, but particular in those southern states with Republican governors.
It's just amazing. You know, I mean, you would think this would not get so politicized, but everything is politicized yeah. these days. And, you know, there are people who have done these graphs, like these very simple graphs where they put the percent that voted for Trump and the percent of people who are vaccinated or death rates, you know, all these different ways of graphing things out, either by states, by county, whatever. And it is a very strong correlation there, because there is so much of a turn against government. And, you know, I mean, you read some of these stories of people who are, even people who are like in the hospital who are very, very sick, and they're still denying that that it's COVID. You know, they believe something they read on Facebook or some particular person who they, you know, and so they're unwilling to sort of really grasp reality.
There was a time, as you and Douglas Harris mentioned, in the 50s and early 60s, when government trust in government, when a public trust in the government was pretty high, and there, the economy was going well, things were looking good, we weren't involved in any major international entanglements at the time. Can we get back to that? Should we get back to that?
In some ways, I don't think so. Maybe not to that level, because you're talking about like somewhere around 70% really strong trust in government. I don't think we're going to get back there. I think there always has to be, and I think there's some skepticism is a good thing in a democracy for sure. But, you know, and those, I don't know, I just wonder how we would have done back then if we had this level of distrust, though. Because, you know, part of the reason why trust was so high is we had the New Deal. We, you know, which helped people during the Depression, the war helped people, World War II brought people together. And actually, the government spent a certain amount of attention in trying to really promote this sense of unity among people. You know, we say trust has been unbuilt, but it was built to begin with.
Right.
You know, in some ways, it was put together. So, you know, we would be in real difficulty, I think, would have been a real difficulty back then if we had had these levels of distrust. I mean, like, what would we have done to deal with these massive problems? So I don't know if we could ever get back to it now, but I think that there's ways to recover it to some extent, at least.
Well, it's a fascinating book, At War with Government, Amy Fried, Douglas B. Harris. Amy, thank you so much for coming in and talking about the book. It is a wonderful read. I hope people get their hands on it and check it out, and not only learn how we got here, but perhaps learn a path forward as well.
Great. Thanks so much.
Amy Fried with us on Downtown.